It's my pleasure to open the second panel of the day on an issue which I think all the people who follow this closely think is probably the key to success. It's easy to talk about the politics. It's easy to imagine political agreements. But the hard thing is getting the economy to work. The economy is the underlying nutrients that make it possible to have political compromise. And, of course, the economies in North Africa have a series of problems. There are short-term crises, but there are also long-term vulnerabilities that previous governments found it enormously difficult to address, and that current governments, even more fragile than their predecessors at the current time, often find even more difficult to address. At the same time, we look out at the region, we see untapped potential. We see the region not only as a source for global energy supplies, but also new markets, investment, regional trade. And what we have assembled here is what I think is a rather remarkable list of people to help walk us through both where we are and where we might go. Speaking first, Dr. Carolyn Freund is the chief economist for the Middle East and North Africa at the World Bank. She previously worked at the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve, where she focused on economic growth, international trade, and international finance in the developing world and transition countries. After her, Dr. Moussa Nebli is the former governor of the Central Bank of Tunisia. Where I first met him is when he was chief economist and director of Social and Economic Development Group at the World Bank's Middle East and North Africa Division and senior advisor to the World Bank's chief economist. He also served concurrently as the Minister of Economic Development in Tunisia and the Minister of Planning and Regional Development, as well as chairman at the Tunis Stock Exchange. Dr. Mustafa Tarab is the Director General and Chairman of the Board of Trustees of OCP. I will not inflict my French on anybody. That stands for something. You can imagine what it would be. Prior to joining OCP, trust me, it's much better that way. Arabic is easy for me. French is beyond me. Prior to joining OCP, he was the lead regulatory specialist in the Global Information and Communications Department at the World Bank. We also headed the Information for Development Program. He also served as Director General of the National Telecommunications Regulatory Authority in Morocco and as an advisor in the Royal Cabinet in Rabat and as an analyst in transportation systems for Bechtel Civil and Minerals Incorporated. What we are trying to understand through this panel, and as I say, I think a quite remarkable array of talent to address it, is what are the strategies to address the issues of unemployment, of education, and social spending? What's the near-term strategy? What's the longer-term strategy? What kinds of approaches can governments take to provide a social safety net? Obviously, the transition to adapting the social safety net to different kinds of structures, different kinds of restraints is very, very important. We look and see, we see a weak European economy and a European economy that's much more integrated with North Africa. What does European recovery mean for the things, the political and economic changes we're concerned about in North Africa? And then, of course, are questions of the U.S. role and of the role of Islamist parties that are rising and what's their attitude toward change. So there are a host of important issues. We have a host of expertise. And I'll ask Dr. Freund to begin, if you would. Thank you.
First, let me start by thanking the organizers for inviting me. And I'm especially honored to join this esteemed panel. I also recognize that I'm less of an expert on the region than the other panelists. So coming from the World Bank, I'm going to talk in part about the economic challenges in the framework of lessons from other regions, which is really the comparative advantage of the World Bank. So I'm going to discuss three issues in my remarks today. First, some experiences from other democratic transitions, because the Arab Spring was remarkable. It was unprecedented. But there are also previous episodes that are somewhat similar. So, in fact, we can identify 90 other transitions in the last 50 years that we might be able to learn something from. Second, I'm going to talk about some of the critical economic challenges and opportunities that the region faces, and focus exactly on one of the things that was mentioned, the long-run versus short-run challenges. And finally, about the environment facing external actors. So let me start with transitions. Some questions that are often raised are, what can we expect before, during, and after these kinds of transitions? How long is it going to be before growth fully recovers? Will governance improve? Can one country learn from another? So to answer this question, what we did was we simply pulled together all the transitions that have taken place over the last 50 years and looked at this data to see, are there obvious patterns that emerge? So what we did was we used this database, which is the Polity4 database. I'm sure some of the political scientists here are familiar with it, which ranks autocracies and democracies from 0 to 10. And what you can do is look at what happens if you have a regime that's in autocracy and it suddenly jumps to democracy and is able to sustain it. So we create this kind of filter where we can define successful democracy transitions, successful democratic transitions, as a sustained and substantial increase in this index. And we can define failed ones as a situation where it improves but then goes back, or improves only slightly. And then finally, gradual ones where this index slowly changes over time. And just to give you some statistics, there were 90 transitions in the last 50 years. This is Eastern Europe. This is Latin America. This is Africa. This is Asia, all over. A few in MENA as well. 45% were successful. In MENA, it includes Lebanon. 30% were failed. In MENA, it includes Algeria in our sample, Iran, and Djibouti. And 15% were gradual, so they were the slow type of transition. What happened during these transitions? Well, very similar to what we saw happen in Tunisia. Growth plummeted in 1 year by about 5 percentage points on average, exactly what we saw in Tunisia, where we had 3% growth in 2010, and it dropped to -2 last year. But it recovered really quickly in most transitions. This is also what we're seeing in Tunisia. It's back up to predicted at 2% this year. And this is kind of what happens in most transitions. And then a few years out, it goes back to normal. And one thing that's especially interesting in these rapid transitions is the long-run growth after transition tends to be somewhat higher than the pre-transition growth by about a percentage point. So that regime change did stimulate some sort of economic changes that improved growth prospects. But of special interest, it didn't matter if the democratic transition was successful or failed. We see that effect in both types. In contrast, the gradual transitions, these slow transitions, tend to actually have the worst outcomes. They have growth dips that are about double what we see in the rapid transitions and are much more protracted, taking 5 years before growth improves. But it does, within the gradual, there's two kinds of groups. There's the group that's gradual because the democracy doesn't take hold, so there's constant struggle and uncertainty, and there's a group that does it really well in a predictable way. Ghana is such a country that had very strong growth during a gradual transition because they did it in a predictable way with a very popular leader in power who was actually the one who turned it to a democracy and managed to stay in power and get elected in a free and fair election. So it is possible to do the gradual transition well. But the reason the growth is worse on average during gradual transitions is because of uncertainty. And this is what we're seeing now in this region, where uncertainty is so high a recent survey we did of investors, the World Bank did jointly with the Economic Intelligence Unit, showed that 60% of investors are on the sidelines or withdrawing investment in developing MENA. So uncertainty is the first thing. Countries really need a plan to resolve this uncertainty in order to bring investment and growth back. One other thing we saw from this study is that there are spillover effects. Spillover effects in the form of regional spillover effects. Whole regions are more likely to see successful transitions. If you look at a map of these transitions, you see that regions tend to move together if one country moves first. So this puts some pressure on Tunisia really to get it right. It sparked the revolutions. If it can get it right, it can have a huge demonstration effect for the rest of the region. So just to sum up on this first point, what I want to emphasize is that in these rapid transitions, irrespective of whether they go back to autocracy or succeed, growth tends to resume, and just replacing the regime tends to improve the outcome, because leaders realize they'll get ousted if they don't improve things, perhaps. But predictability and setting a roadmap for transition are so important. This uncertainty during what happens in these gradual transitions that are gradual not by design, but by default, that's a real problem. The second point I want to talk about is some of the main economic challenges, and really focusing on the long-run, short-run trade-offs. Because if we don't get the short-run right, there's a danger that the long-run is going to be compromised as a result. So if we think about the structural issues, one thing that sums it up to me is if we look at China, China's been growing at 10% with unemployment below 5%. If we look at countries like Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, we see precisely the reverse. We see growth under 5%, around 5%, and unemployment well above 10%. Why is this the case? Why has growth been so slow? And that's overall growth. If you look at per capita growth, the statistics are even worse. Well, there's a few reasons. I mean, a bulk of it is this absence of a vibrant private sector. But why hasn't the private sector been able to take off? There's the bloated government sector, where we see higher wages and more workers in that sector than in other similar economies. There's the so-called skills mismatch, where businesses say they can't find qualified workers, but workers at the same time are saying they can't find good jobs. And that's because the education system has developed in a way where people are getting educated for a certain type of job, which is a public sector job, not for a private sector job. The incentives are in the wrong place. High fuel subsidies that have sort of characterized the region's type of social safety net is also a big problem. It's not just a big problem because it's costly to the fisc. It's also a big problem because they're regressive. They don't even target the population you want to target, because rich people have bigger houses, more cars, more appliances, etc. And they tend to go to industry. But by going to industry, there's a double burden there, because you're actually subsidizing one input, which is fuel, while taxing labor, yet your main opportunity is a big labor force. You want to take advantage of the human capital, yet policy is pushing industry to take advantage of fuel instead. There's also the poor business climate, which has been recognized in a number of reports. We have one that came out before the Arab Spring, Privilege to Competition, where the private sector is characterized by a lot of rules and regulations that aren't uniformly enforced, so it's very difficult for businesses to compete and new businesses to start. And finally, in some cases, there's evidence of overvaluation of the real exchange rate. And this is a big problem in a day and age when a lot of countries around the world are competing not with competitive exchange rates, but actually with undervalued exchange rates. And we see this in the forms of high trade deficits and decreasing as opposed to increasing diversification of the export structure. So why has this been so hard to change? Many of the things I've talked about are recognized going back years and years. Well, reform is very costly. So there's this kind of J curve of reform where when you try to remove subsidies, the industry you have is going to get hurt, and it's going to be a few years before the new industry develops. And these people are organized to want to keep those subsidies in place. So reform is very costly in the short run. So the biggest challenge is how can governments respond to get the long-run growth without hurting the short run? So there are some short-run things that can be done in order to make the longer-run reforms that are necessary more palatable. And one of these is we need to see more avoidance of backsliding. So the first response, and I think this was mentioned in the previous panel, after the Arab Spring begun, was to increase public sector wages and to raise subsidies, when these are precisely the things that are preventing you from having long-run growth. And more recently, at least in Morocco, we've seen an increase in fuel prices, which is an encouraging sign. But there are also ways to try for some quick wins and confidence-building measures, and these can include things on the political side, like improved access to information. Tunisia's made steps in that direction. Morocco is as well. Improved service delivery, better inclusion, such as the National Initiative for Human Development program in Morocco. SMEs, while these are not going to be a cure for jobs, they can help to build confidence. And, of course, there's labor-intensive public works, simply using fiscal policy to bump up employment. There's also little things countries can do. And just to give one example here is from a country that transitioned and did make a dent on corruption, something most countries don't do, is Georgia. Georgia had a policy of Georgia without corruption. They jumped from 83rd, well worse than all the North African countries on the Corruption Perceptions Index in 2002, to 35th percentile, leapfrogging all the North Africans in 2011. They fired the entire police force. Accidents actually decreased. This is how bad their police force was. They trained a new one. They used external assistance to pay the salaries of the workers. They housed their police in glass police stations. That was taking transparency to a new level. So there are things that can be done. They put billboards everywhere if you go to Georgia saying numbers you can call if you're asked for a bribe. So there are things that can be done that build immediate trust and confidence. So finally, I know I have to wrap up. The last point I would like to make is on challenges facing external actors. There's the usual challenges we face operating under uncertainty with changing counterparts, changing circumstances, unclear bent, whether it's going to go populist or free market, asymmetric information. There's also this long-run and short-run trade-off I've been talking about that as development specialists, it's tempting for us to go towards the long run, but we also have to think about the short run. But the more unique challenge in this region is distrust because of our own past real and perceived failures. And Gallup poll evidence shows that, for example, in countries like Egypt and Libya, you see a worsening of a demand for assistance from World Bank and IMF. they'd prefer to get assistance from within the region, though in Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia, the polls aren't going in that direction. It's still rather favorable. So we're trying to be humble and recognize this. We're also trying to do things differently, focusing more on governance, especially accountability and inclusion, that because income inequality did not actually look so bad in this region before, there was a sense that that wasn't the main problem. But clearly, there's something about equality of opportunity that we had missed. And build trust, meeting with a broader range of people. Part of this is using social media. We've developed a Facebook page for the MENA region at the World Bank, and we have a very active blog. And then finally, the last point I'll make is that this is just a really bad time for transition. We have the global economy in the doldrums. So while the world should be focused on the Arab Spring, instead, every time you pick up the paper, it's focused on Greece and the Eurozone. And so that's just pulling people towards a different topic, which is unfortunate. And it also just means there's really limited scope for serious initiatives, either through trade and migration or through funds. The money's just not there. That said, of course, there's a great deal of regional wealth. But so far, it has failed to materialize in a sizable and predictable way. So I'm already out of time, so let me conclude there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nebley.
First, let me thank the CSIS for this opportunity to be here. To be invited to be here with you today. We are asked to talk about the challenges and the economic challenges and opportunities. And let me start by saying two things. Talking about economic challenges or opportunities cannot be discussed independently of the political process and political transition. And let me illustrate that by two points. By saying there are two rules or two stylized facts about transition which are really important to keep in mind when we discuss economic strategies. The first is it's related a little bit to what Caroline was saying, that any successful political transition requires a strong economic recovery and vice versa. There is a strong interaction between the political transition and the economic transition. If one works well and the other one works well, you are successful. But if one works bad and then the other one is not going to work well, and you are likely to fail this. This means one thing that is extremely important up front, that if your political transition, as we discussed in the first session, is not going so smoothly and then it's lots of uncertainty and lots of problems, then your economic transition is going to be suffering as well. And you are unlikely to have a good strategy and or a clear strategy for economic transition. And actually, built in the program of this discussion today, that it's like one can deal with economic challenges opportunity abstractly of what's happening on the political arena, which is not possible. It doesn't happen. That doesn't work that way. And my talk will illustrate this in some more detail in a few minutes. The second stylized fact of rule of transitions that I would like to highlight is what I like to call the iron law of transitions. The iron law of transition will say something like this: things would get worse, much worse, before they get any better. And this is something that is happening across the board. Almost everything except one thing. Whether you talk about security gets worse because it gets better. Corruption gets worse before it gets eventually better, if it ever does. Quality of delivery of public services gets worse before eventually it gets better. Growth collapses before it improves. Unemployment increases before eventually it decreases. Everything. Investment collapses before. So everything, almost everything in the economic life, and even non-economic life, behaves that way. And the whole problem is, how do you get things better eventually as soon as possible. The just in parenthesis, the exception that I would like to mention just in passing is a freedom of expression. It tends not to follow the iron law. Freedom of expression has tended, whether you look in Morocco or Tunisia or Libya, it has improved and has stayed, better throughout. And that's the only exception I can think of, actually, in this. Now, what does this tell us? This tells us that really the biggest challenge in the economic area is how to navigate this economic, the political transition, and minimize the costs of this collapse, initial collapse, and engineer eventually a recovery that is fast enough and that puts you a new path that is eventually better to meet the challenges of growth, employment, and inclusiveness and inclusiveness. That's really the big. Now, I would like to say that from what I see, there are really two major challenges. The first top challenges, if you like. There are many others, but two major that I would like to emphasize in this transition and in building a strategy for recovery and for eventually higher growth. One is the macroeconomics, and the second is the role of private sector, because it's critical for employment and for growth. Now, to illustrate it with what I mean, I would like to discuss, when I discuss the macroeconomics challenges, say a few words about what the situation was before the revolution, what happens during transition, and what's likely to happen, in the medium term and in the long term. So when we look at the macroeconomics, we see that when I'm talking about Tunisia to a large extent, but I think what I say applies broadly speaking to Egypt and even to Libya in many ways, and Morocco and so on, with different nuances, but broadly the same. We know that the North African country's macroeconomics was not bad before the revolutions. Countries had relative macroeconomic stability, relatively low inflation, typically, reasonable fiscal policies, no major fiscal imbalances. Debt was brought back to control after some digressions. No financial crisis. So things on the macro side were, real exchange rates were, maybe overvalued a little bit here and there, but no major, really. It's not something that you can really talk about as a major thing. So we had the initial conditions, if you like, at the revolution were fine. I mean, no major, you are not facing a major challenge. So what happens to the transition on the macroeconomic side? Essentially, it has become very difficult to maintain macroeconomic balances, and pressures were for imbalances to build during the transition for many reasons. The first one is on the fiscal side. Clearly, there was very much pressure to increase expenditures to meet what the so-called social needs, which were the origin of the revolution, whether it was employment or whether it was regional imbalances and so on. There is a lot of pressure to increase expenditures, including through employment, including through increasing wages, subsidies, and all kinds of things. So public expenditures, shot up. Whether it's in Egypt or Tunisia, you had a huge increase in public expenditures. Fiscal deficits increased. Debt started to increase, and so on. And eventually, this had an impact on inflation. Inflation started to go up. Current account deficits started to increase in 2011 and expect in 2012. Pressures on exchange rates. So you have serious deterioration in the macro situation. And the problem is that many, and I will come back to this, many of these pressures are not reversible. They're built-in pressures that are likely to continue in the medium term. Which means, going back to the medium term and the prospects in the medium and long term, a lot of macro uncertainty is built into the system. Lots of macro uncertainty. Fiscal balances are really at high risk. because many of the public expenditures are recurrent, are not going to be reversed, whether it is wages or employment, higher wages, higher employment, public employment, including subsidies. So public debt is likely to continue to increase. Many sources of new source of old and new source of contingent liabilities are building up in the social security areas, in the banking sectors, and so on. Therefore, there is, in the medium term, significant risks on the fiscal side, on the macroeconomic side, and so on. This risks also putting pressures on competitiveness if the exchange rates don't adjust quickly enough, and so on. So what we have is that in this macro frameworks are really under pressure, and they are likely to remain so in the medium term. And this is going to be a big challenge for facing the new challenges and building an investment climate which is conducive to higher growth and so on. So this is some problem that is building up that we should keep in mind. The second major challenge, I think, that we should be aware is related to the private sector. I think Caroline was talking a little bit earlier about why the private sector was not strong and growth was not high enough before the revolution and so on. I think there has been a lot of discussion of this and a lot of debates. My own view is that I have come to this conclusion and that before the revolution, one of the basic weaknesses of the private sector, despite the reforms that were undertaken in the 80s and 90s and so on, the private sector did not really meet the challenge, did not grow as would have been expected. And the basic reason for me was the credibility of the political systems. I think corruption was going up. Private sector was never, the credibility of property rights was always a question mark, and therefore the private sector was never really sure that it can grow and thrive. And this has meant that this credibility issue and property rights issue was a central one that explains. It's much more than business climate and much more than, labor market policies and so on. Now, what happens during the transition? In principle, the revolutions were supposed to resolve that problem. Because if you are going towards a democratic government, you are supposed to go into a system where there is rule of law, where you have credibility, protection of property rights, therefore better governance, and therefore the political system should be conducive to higher investment and higher growth. But the problem is that in the interim, the iron law of transition applies. Actually, credibility, gets worse because you still do not have a new political system in place. You don't know who is going to be designing economic policies. You don't know whether the new political regime is really going to be protecting property rights as expected or not. And therefore, what you have in the interim period is a decline in private investment, a decline in the activity of private sector, and the wait and see, I think, the 60% that Caroline was mentioning is symptomatic of that. So in the transition, things get worse, and therefore the private sector is not going to play. Addition to that, and there are some specific, there is this perception that develops that the private sector is corrupt anyway. It was linked to the previous regimes. It was rich because of corruption, and therefore it has to be brought to account. And this brings all this issue of transitional, what is so-called transitional justice, and what do you do with that? All of this, means that the private sector is not going to be playing that role during the transition, and you are going to be facing major challenge. That's what explains the collapse in growth. That's what collapse of employment, increase in employment, and so on, which is exactly the opposite of where we want to go. It's going the other way. So this is a major challenge. So in terms of prospects, the big, big challenge is to reverse that trajectory. And that is why it's so important. It's so important that the political transition gets, moving in a predictable way with, good roadmap and predictability in terms of what's happening and of the rules that eventually will be prevailing in the economic area and so on. So that brings me to the first rule I was talking about. So the successful transition is contingent on political recovery, economic recovery is contingent on a successful political transition, and therefore, so that this political and economic transition can go hand in hand and resolve the issues. Now, economic strategy and challenges, clearly there are lots of them, other issues. I mean, besides this macro and the private sector, we can talk about business environment, we can talk about education, skills mismatch. Oh, there are tons of them. And the World Bank has, potential to work on tons of things, but we have to keep in perspective the relative importance of things. I don't think, playing around with business environment rules here and business is really the most important thing at this stage. It's really focus on the major things, which, as I said, are really the macro and the credibility of the political transition is really the most important thing. Now, I don't know how long do I have to conclude? 2 seconds? Yeah. What I was planning to say is that where do we stand in terms of the positions of the political parties and the political players in terms of this economic challenges and so on? I would say two or three very quick things. First, political parties don't have views on macroeconomics. Political parties don't have clear views on the medium-term strategies. There are no political party which says, I'd like to have, a bad macro, or I want to have, an increase in expenditures, I don't care what happens to the exchange rate, or what happens to inflation. Everybody would like to have more expenditures, but stable exchange rate, no debt. But their views are inconsistent, typically. It's not that they have a strategy to make things bad, but they like the good things, but they don't like to have to see that there is a budget constraint and they have to worry about budget constraint. So political parties don't know budget constraints. That's the problem with political parties. Which means that when they get into trouble, as I was saying, in terms of risks and the macroeconomics, it's not because they want to run the risks, because they are, dealing with the short-term issues, and they are trying to postpone the constraints for the future. And that's what gets you into trouble, typically. So there is no debate on those issues in any explicit way. So on the other hand, if you want really to deal with the macro issues and the economic challenges, you have got to deal with the subsidy issues. Subsidies are becoming the major issues. You have to deal with the public sector employment issue. You have to deal with the wages. You have to deal with some of the contingent liabilities, major issues building up in Algeria, in Egypt, in Tunisia, on social security. Major issues building in Tunisia, major issue in the banking sector and the portfolios of the banking sector, the recapitalization needs and so on. So this is a major issue and so on. In terms of the other areas, in terms of the private sector and growth, all of the parties, almost all of them, would tell you that private sector is really critical, except some of the leftists. There are some leftist parties who say, okay, we like private sector, but private sector is bad anyway, but we try to deal with the private sector. But how to do it and what is required to do is really remains. And how do you achieve really an improvement in the credibility of government in preserving property rights, so that governance and political parties do not act as they did before as grabbing hand, if you like, famous grabbing hand of the private sector. But what we are seeing a continuation of the same now. During the transition, actually, we are seeing some of the party behaving with the private sector as the old regime used to behave with the private sector. So it means that the improvement in credibility of the private sector is not really happening. So this is likely to undermine any recovery of growth, any recovery of investment, and any dealing with the employment challenge. So to sum up, my bottom line is that it is tough. The transition is difficult. It's likely to continue to be difficult. And there is no way to meet the economic challenges of employment, growth, and so on if the political transition does not go successfully and quickly and does not drag on. Because if it drags on, I think it's really a recipe for a major failure. And therefore, both the political transition and the economic transition will be in jeopardy. I will stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nebli. Dr. Terrell.
Good morning, everybody. I'm also thankful for CSIS for arranging and organizing this conference on a topic that I feel is more important than it gets attention in some circles, namely Maghreb. I have a big challenge. They put me on a panel with two prominent economists, and I'm not going to be foolish enough to try to give you any insights on current account deficit or fiscal deficit, although I agree with something, many things you said, in particular that the exchange rate has been overvalued, although very easy to say from an exporting company. But indeed, there are some of these challenges there. Look, what I want to do is share with you an experience from a very different perspective, which is that of a state-owned enterprise, very anecdotal ideas. But I hope that, and I'm sure they'll reinforce some of the things that were said before. First, I think that we are definitely embarking on a new era from an economic point of view in countries in the Maghreb. I also have to say that my knowledge is really more on Morocco, although I think that countries like Tunisia share the same challenges. So take what I'm going to say as the statements on Morocco. So, but what I think in terms of these transitions, and we talked about political transition before, in terms of the economic transition, I think as much as the political transition, there's a unique characteristic we should keep in mind is there's going to be forced transition as opposed to chosen transition. I think it's very important to realize that a lot of the things we're discussing today in terms of reforms, and you eloquently outlined, were discussions we had with economic partners and international finance institutions and development agencies in the early 90s. We talked about the importance of private sector development, and Mustafa, you were that very instrumental at that time. We talked about the importance of some reforms, including the subsidy scheme. In the 90s, many missions from the World Bank and IMF came to Morocco with big programs on private sector development, etc. I think we chose at that stage, these countries, not to implement these reforms, let's be honest, at least not to fully implement them. But I think what is different today is those reforms are going to be forced on these countries. And I think there are two really key areas here in terms of reform. One is competitiveness. And export competitiveness. Again, after structural adjustment in the 80s, many of these countries, Morocco and indeed Tunisia, passed free trade agreements, first with Europe, in the case of Morocco, also with the U.S., but competitiveness was supposed to be a key ingredient to foster, precisely to shorten the negative part of the J-curve that you mentioned and go quickly to a growth. It didn't happen to a large extent. And the other key area, which also was discussed, we had a lot of programs on education, etc., is more inclusive growth. I think this is also what explains, and if we have to be honest with ourselves, this is all over the literature on development in this region, that explains the paradox. Tunisia and Morocco were, to a certain extent, of course, Algeria, as important as it is, was in a different framework, considered as paradoxes. They went through all the structural adjustment. They did, the basic reforms that needed to be done, and yet growth remained on the average between 4-5%, not the 6-7% that would create any social benefit as was expected. So this is why the paradox was there. Fairly decent growth, not enough to resolve the social problems, but unemployment becoming more and more of a problem. And I have to say also, let's be honest, unemployment amongst graduates, amongst people who were educated in a very expensive education system. What I'm going to try to do is first agree that political transition has to be fast to really get down to the to allow and enable the reforms that need to be done, and they go hand in hand. But I'm afraid that, one, I wish I could be as optimistic as you are. I think we are in long, protracted transitions in our countries. But I think that there are no macro solutions either in terms of economy. I agree that the fundamentals have to be there. But look, we have a paradox. We're talking about, I read yesterday some report from a rating agency saying, look, there's a problem. We may downgrade one of the countries because potential unrest looking forward, at the same time recommending that the subsidy system should also be done with very quickly. Well, I wish we could do both at the same time. I don't think it is the case. Let me go down to what we experienced at OCP, because I think it has some relevance with all modesty. It has some relevance because we are an export-oriented company. We employ 20,000 people, and we represent about a third of Morocco's export. And we lived what I would consider a microcosm of what happened on the Arab Spring, because we deal with three mining cities where the only jobs that exist are OCP jobs. And we, some of the toughest unrest, not unlike what happened in Gafsa, some of the toughest unrest was in the mining cities. And these youth demanded jobs with OCP. Okay. Our response was first to analyze the situation. Why did these people need jobs at the same time as our growth path was very, very good? OCP is investing tremendously in terms of growth. We're creating jobs. Our subcontractors are creating jobs in these areas. Yet the youth from these areas are not the ones employed in these jobs. Worse, we import labor in Morocco. In industrial and construction and thing, and this is not unlike other countries also in MENA, or at least in North Africa, in MENA indeed, we import labor. So obviously what you mentioned, Caroline and Mustafa, the mismatch between what the education system produces and what our needs are. Well, we said we can knock on Rabat's door and say, please speed up the reform process of the education system. What we did is took questions in our own hands. We created a program called OCP Skills, where not our job, but we're currently training 15,000 youth from the regions. We opened up a list, 95,000 youth registered for the program. And from the outset, we told them these are not jobs within OCP. We're going to train you and enhance your employability for jobs with our own subcontractors and with some of our partners. Okay? We know very well through our development program what type of skills are going to be needed looking 5 years, 10 years ahead. And we train them according to those skills. We also talk very nicely to our subcontractors and invite them to look closely at these opportunities in terms of jobs. The point here, what I'm trying to make, the point I'm trying to make is part of the answer is not going to come from government or the administration or the private sector, but also from state-owned enterprises. And the large private sector companies, let's face it, that depend on government procurement for many of their activities. So I think, and I know that the present government, which is part of the regime, by the way, but the present government is looking very closely at what we're doing and trying to entice private and state-owned companies to try to tailor some of what they can do to this kind of experience. What I'm saying is that there are solutions also on the ground. Innovation happens on the ground. It doesn't happen from Washington or from Paris. In fact, the other ingredient we need is not only partners that listen to us and try to tailor their program to the experience on the ground, but I think I'll finish with this. I think there are two key perception issues, problems that we have to deal with. The first one, and I think we saw some of this today, is we view too much North Africa, and indeed the whole of Africa, including sub-Saharan Africa, as an area of problem. Well, look, talking today, this is a big area of stability comparatively. It is an area that has grown 4 or 5% even during the worst times of the crisis, 2008, 9, and 10. This is an area where youth is available and wants to be trained. These are areas of opportunities, not areas of problems. Too many public policies from the north and consequently too many business strategies consider this not as an area of opportunity. Food security is a case in point. I'm talking to it because we're in that we produce fertilizers. If we consider that between now and 2050 we'll get at least 2 billion more people on this earth, and that the only really available arable land to speak of is in Africa, and if you look at the international agenda, Africa, and you put two columns, problem solutions, Africa is consistently put in the problem column, whereas it is, and it's going to be a big part of the solution. So we have a perception problem. The Euromed, the partnership with Europe, I have to say, maybe I can be less politically correct than others, has viewed North Africa as a problem to be contained, not as an opportunity for competitiveness and increased competitiveness of European companies. That was completely missed, to a certain extent. Okay, the second problem, and I would say the perception problem, and here I'm even going to be less politically correct than I probably should, is the MENA, what I call the MENA syndrome, is viewing exclusively Maghreb as part of the Middle East or as the southern part of Europe and missing its main nature, its main identity, which is Africa. We're part of Africa. You know, the World Bank has a MENA department, has an African department, doesn't consider that North Africa is part of Africa. Many diplomacies have North African partners, policies that are part of a broader Middle East policy. So I beg you to consider that North Africa is also part of Africa. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So there you have it, the economic issues seen from the broad comparative perspective down to the regional perspective, down to the firm perspective. Thank you very much to our panelists for helping lead us down that progression. We have about 15 minutes for questions. I would ask if you could please identify yourself, if you could only ask one question, and then my pet peeve, if you could ask your question in the form of a question, which is to ask a genuine question of our distinguished panelists and not to make a statement and say, what do you think of my statement? I see a hand right over there, the lady right there.
Hi, I'm Ann Pence. I'm formerly an economist with the State Department, but now I actually work with Mustafa Tarab. So I wanted to get that out front. You guys have presented a rather challenging perspective on how economic opportunity, as Mustafa put it, can be realized in the region. So, Mustafa, you were giving us some very concrete examples from your experience, but I would like the panel to tell us what sorts of things can actually contribute to this competitiveness, and how does the outside world, if you will, the USG, the rest of us, help you with that? And is it foreign direct investment and opening up more to that? What are the changes that together we can make in the near term to help surmount this transition period and take advantage of these opportunities, which most of us think are very real?
Thank you very much. Who would like to start? Caroline, did you want to?
Say something. I think I'll actually agree with Mustafa Tarab on the importance of large firms. So in other work that we've done and what's popular in the trade literature now is a tremendous skewness of exports we see around the world. So around the world, the top single firm in most countries accounts for 15% of exports. The top 1%, more than 50% of exports. So it's really the large firms that are going to create the exports, the growth, and the jobs. So there needs to be an environment that fosters firms to be able to grow into these large firms and to export. And to me, a big part of that, especially for small countries that aren't going to have negative effects on the rest of the world, and when we see a world that countries are competing with undervalued exchange rates, is the exchange rates, a huge tool that can be used. So look at Switzerland, under 6% unemployment in this euro crisis, undervalued exchange rate. Look at Germany, record employment, undervalued exchange rate. Look at China. It's just the exchange rate is such an immediate tool to create jobs and growth, especially after crisis. That's how Indonesia got out of its crisis. That's how Argentina got out of its crisis. I mean, there was a balance of payments issue there, obviously, but the exchange rate's an important tool. Then, as I mentioned in my discussion, there's also political and confidence-building measures and labor-intensive public works, et cetera. Thank you.
I think this is the question that we face every day. What can be done in the near term to create jobs and to meet some of the pressures that you have in the labor market. And the options, immediate options, these easy options are not really so much available. As I was saying, because the engine of growth of creating jobs in the private sector is really has the blues. It's not investing. It's not ready to create jobs. It's not ready to take risks. So you can talk about all of the things that you want them to do, but they are waiting. And the big firms, international firms, are waiting. They're not ready to move. So the big things that you can do, and that was this what I wanted to do, is really make sure that you get back to some reasonably predictable and stable environment, politically, socially, and macroeconomically. That's really the point I was trying to make. Now, I would add something else, since I'm speaking in Washington and things. The other thing that can be done is fix Europe. Help fix Europe. Help fix Europe. And the U.S. should be doing something. And we are not seeing the U.S. doing much about Europe. And by fixing Europe, you are helping us. Because Europe, because we have been losing jobs because of the crisis in Europe. Actually, we have a huge loss of jobs for the last 6 months. I mean, since the beginning of 2012. I think up to 2011, things were okay. But starting in 2012, you know, probably, I don't know, Caroline, can February or March, really things start to become bad. And we start looking for jobs. So you're asking me, how do you create them? How can I preserve what I have? And Europe is really destroying jobs and things. So try to help Europe. I think that will help us. And this will help the democratic transition. And by helping the democratic transition as well and stabilizing the political environment and so on, this we can create jobs. After that, I mean, there are lots of other things that can be done in terms of fixing all kinds of incentives and things. I mean, you name it. I mean, reforms, there are thousands of things that you need to do every day. You have to get your priorities right. You have to focus on the important things first.
Do you agree the focus on large firms rather than small ones?
I'm not sure I agree fully. Because when you look at the exports, yes, but the exports is only part of the story because you have domestic market as well. So the domestic market has also the SMEs and the small firms, which are important. So what Caroline, in terms of the exports, competitiveness, and so on, the large firms are really, the big. But then she knows also that a lot of dynamism of exports come from the SMEs and that eventually create, innovate, and create and grow eventually. When you take a cross section, it looks like this. But for the domestic market, a lot of the business is in the SME sector that should be.
Maybe just to say that, I agree that Europe, but I don't think it's going to be fixed very soon. Unfortunately, I think there is something emerging that is that we're overlooking, which is the global South. We just ran a conference in Rabat on the global Atlantic, trying to look at opportunities that are now emerging in the southern, in the southern Atlantic, with countries like Brazil and the whole of Africa. So there is a dynamic, and we've seen Moroccan businesses, of course, wishing that Europe will be fixed, but also. Looking very strongly at Africa as an area of growth and opportunity. So, I think that, by the way, Mustafa, part of fixing Europe is also Europe looking at Africa in a different themselves looking at Africa in a different prism. But nevertheless, in terms of the SME issue, of course, it's not a silver bullet, but consider that. A company like OCP, I'm sure this is the case in Sonatrach, for example, uses as subcontractors and partners about 500 industrial companies in Morocco. So indeed, our competitiveness depends on their competitiveness, but there's a lot we can do to help them become more competitive and become, by the way, also export-oriented.
Thank you very much. I saw a question here at this front table and then one at the back table. So,
thank you. I am Ted Moran, a professor of international business at Georgetown University. Do Morocco and Tunisia have private sectors that are alert, energetic, imaginative risk takers, or more tranquil, risk-averse, only wanting to engage in familiar and comfortable activities? And from a comparative perspective, do we know anything about how to get more of the former and less of the latter?
Thank you.
Yes, I think what couple of years ago, I think the it was at Brookings. What's his name? Noland and wrote a book on the Arab economies. I don't remember what the title exactly. And the main thesis of that book is that there are no entrepreneurs in the Middle East, and they're not creative and so on and so on. And this, how do you fix that problem? And I think this is a misleading appreciation of the situation. I mean, entrepreneurship and trade started in the Middle East and North Africa. Carthage is, you know, millennium, and traders and entrepreneurs is really based is in the genes of the Carthaginians and the Tunisians, which are as well as the rest of the Middle East, and whether it's Egypt or Syria or so it's really, it has to do with the environment. And the environment, when you look at it, I think when the conditions are right and the environment is supportive, it's incredible how much enterprising businesses will appear. And we know some of them have been able, even in very difficult environment, to thrive and to become very, as you say, very alert, very innovative and expansive. And there are a number of multinationals now. They've become multinationals, even in extremely difficult conditions, private sector, Morocco, Tunisian, Egyptian, and what have you. So I think there are, but also there are lazy ones. There are ones who have been living off the connections they have and through the corruption and the relationships and the rent-seeking and so on. So you have both. And that was my point. My point is, how is it that you can create the environment where the private sector feels sufficiently safe in terms of what it can do and in terms of what it cannot do, in terms of what it can own and cannot own, so that it can thrive and can enterprise? And this has not been there because, I mean, the previous regime, Ben Ali regime, was essentially trying to capture most of what the private sector could give. I mean, they were trying to control all of the private sector. You had a business, and they come and ask you to share, so take part. So it's only so that the businesses was really geared towards the cronies. So you have a cronyism really very, very become. And not forget, this is part of the revolution, actually. We don't forget. One of the reasons of the revolution, in Tunisia at least, and trying to explain, I mean, I have talked about this last year. I don't like to talk about it now because when the youth revolted, clearly about jobs, but also about corruption, and about corruption that was endemic in the private sector. Not the corruption in the public sector, which is one. But the private sector, because the headline news were becoming what the son-in-law or the brother-in-law or the sister-in-law has captured in terms of firm and business and so on. And this made people revolt. It's part of the story. We forget about it. So that private sector, if you like, which is, but there is another one which has a lot of potential, which can
try. Let me see if we can just slip in one more question. This gentleman had his hand up from the very beginning, and then we'll have to move to the next panel.
Hi, Joshua Polachek from the State Department. From what I've been hearing, we've been hearing about the revolutions and the political revolutions and the change in the private sector. But since 2005, with the Arab Development Report and a series of reports going on beyond that, we've been aware of something called the Arab Paradox, of where they've closed the gap, the educational gap in gender. Yet if you look economically, a large percentage of the female population in the Maghreb, but also across the Arab world, is largely excluded from the economy. They're not productive members of the economy. Do you think that there's any prospect for an economic revolution or a second revolution to bring that half of the population into the economy and to contribute to the prosperity and stability in these economies? Thank you.
So we're almost out of time. We can do that quickly. Something about women. how that plays in.
I get you. I guess you'll, you want to, but you're not. You
well, it's very true. So the region has the lowest rate of labor force participation among women compared with all other regions, and then despite the small rate of participation, there's the highest rate of unemployment of the women in the labor force. So it's a very small fraction across countries that are employed, and so this is a tremendous resource that's not being utilized. There's studies that if it were to be utilized, how much higher growth and income would be. Unfortunately, I would say that at least in the short run, I'm not very optimistic about a change in this, both for what's happening in general on the gender front because of shifts in government, but then also even if growth were to do better, it's not always the case that women come in. We've seen in Turkey, actually, a worsening situation of women in the labor force, as Turkey's always put as the example. So it is on economic growth. It is on its integration. But if you look at women's participation, it's really not. This is a tremendously important issue and one that we at the World Bank focus on a lot. But I think it really has to be homegrown and born in the region to change things, both through legislation and court cases. That's how change has come about sometimes in the U.S., through more opportunities in child care and just a general change in mentality.
I think, honestly, based on my experience in the Middle East, that's an optimistic answer, because I'm actually pretty optimistic about the capacities of women in the region based on the women I know, but also where, after we get through this dip, where the trajectory will go. I want to thank our panelists for a very thought-provoking discussion, and we will move right to the next panel. Thank you.